One of the most striking things about Barack Obama is that he remains something of a mystery. He may be the most famous person in the world, but it would seem that a lot of people say they still really don't know him, unlike Bill Clinton, who was the subject of your last presidential biography. How do you explain this?
Well, there are different ways that people see him as a mystery. And part of it has to do with the way he came on the scene. I mean, it was only, think about it, in the year 2000, he went out to the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles and spent a day there, and nobody knew him, and his credit card bounced, and he had to come back home. 8 years later, he's president of the United States. So some of that just has to do with the meteoric rise. I mean, so many of our public figures we've known throughout their adult lives, and his we really didn't until later. Then you have, on top of that, the fact that he's really, in many ways, a classic American, yet a global figure. And so, you know, there are parts of his family history that are exotic to some people in this country. And I think that adds a bit to the mystery. And then, in some ways, he is, you know, there's a chapter in my book where I call him the moviegoer. He's a little bit sort of a participant observer of his own life. So he's not as viscerally there as so many other politicians. He doesn't have that same narcissistic or neurotic or compulsive need to be with people.
And that's what everyone comments about Obama. I mean, in terms of his personality, his coolness, his emotional reserve, as if he's always kind of watching things, examining things from a distance.
Yeah. One of his girlfriends that I got her journal writes about the veil between Barack Obama and her and her Barack Obama and the world. And I thought, you know, that was when he was 22 years old. It was fairly perceptive and to some degree echoed in the President Obama that we see today. That's not to say that he doesn't have charisma and that he can't be a charmer, which both of which he has and can be. But it's not always there. He sort of vacillates. There's a certain ambivalence to him that is rare for a politician.
So do you think that coolness, that reserve is just sort of a basic personality trait, or can you trace it back to the circumstances of his upbringing?
You know, I see both nature and nurture in it. In terms of his upbringing, coming out of Hawaii, where people tend to be sort of, I was with a woman today who's from Honolulu, and she said, you know, we're kind of soft. Can he be strong enough? But anyway, there's this native Hawaiian saying, cool head main thing, you know, just be cool, man. And then that's sort of part of his exterior. Then spending 3 formative years in Indonesia, which has a very reserved essence to its culture.
And it's worth pointing out that he spent 3 years in Indonesia at, I would assume, a fairly formative period of his life as a young boy. And everyone talks about Kenya and his connection to Kenya. He never actually lived in Africa, but he lived those years in Indonesia.
Age 6 to 9, he was in Indonesia and completely immersed in that culture. He wasn't like a typical diplomat's child, you know, in the Western bubble of an international school and with Western friends. He was just sink or swim in a Jakarta neighborhood, Menteng Dalam, where he had to learn Bahasa Indonesia, the language, and be with the neighborhood kids and go to the neighborhood school. So he was directly affected by that culture in a way that many foreign visitors or students are not.
I mean, it's really an amazing story. And I would guess a fairly unusual story in terms of the background of someone who became American president. I mean, not just the fact that he's black, but this incredibly international perspective.
Yeah, there are so many elements to Barack Obama that I say are at once classically American because it is an immigrant country. And yet unique, because he is the first of his, you know, the first biracial kid, first African-American, first with an African father, in so many ways, you know, living in Indonesia. There's coming from Hawaii, the most exotic of the 50 states in some sense and the most diverse, although there aren't that many African-Americans there. It's, you know, a many-shaded place. So in all of those different ways, his story is different.
You went to all of these places. I mean, you traveled the world, sort of going to where not only he lived, but where his extended family lived. Did you have to do that to understand this story?
Well, it's the story I wanted to write. So, you know, People can look at this book in different ways, but I only look at it the way I wanted to write it. In other words, the story of his family history is as interesting to me as anything else. And the way I conceived this book, I plan to write a second volume. But there were two threads that go through this book. One is the world that created him, the utter randomness of his life. I mean, all of us are random creations to one degree or another. His is just a little more so. And the ability to write about the modern world in so many different aspects through this one family story. And the second thread is, given that, given all the contradictions that he was born into, how did he figure himself out? So those are the two things I wanted to do with this book, and that's why I went around the world.
What did you learn that you didn't know before?
So many things. Every place. I mean, going to Kenya. Several key things came out in our trip to Kenya. One was just going out to Nyanza province in western Kenya, where the Obama clan is from. They're part of the Luo tribe. And when I was out there, I saw that for the Obamas, even there was a certain element of the local community that considered the Obamas foreigners, aliens, strangers. They called them Jadaks, because they had only been there for like four generations. They didn't really come there for many centuries. So they had to deal with that sort of notion, which is, in a very different way, what Barack Obama, President Obama, has dealt with by some people who just can't accept that he's an American or that he's some kind of a stranger. So I saw that thread starting in Africa. There are many mythologies built up around Barack Obama. One is that he's some kind of a secret Muslim, and it was by going to Kenya that I sort of saw the real story, which is that his grandfather, Hussein Onyango, did convert to Islam after World War I, but that, in fact, at every step along the way in the rise of the Obamas in Kenya, it was evangelical Christian missionaries from the West who were most influential. They're the ones that came out to Western Kenya as Seventh-day Adventists and taught the grandfather English and westernized him. Then the president's father, Barack Obama Sr., was also educated by missionaries and essentially mentored by a particularly fascinating American woman named Betty Mooney, whose grandfather was the founder of Texas Christian University, and she was sent to Kenya as part of her missionary work to spread the gospel and teach literacy. And she hired Barack Obama Sr. to translate some of the book or literacy books into Luo, his tribal language, and really was his mentor from then on. She's the reason he ended up in Hawaii, in the United States, the reason Barack Obama exists.
Hmm. We should talk some about Barack Obama's father, Obama Sr.
Yes.
You say that Barack, the son, the current president, was actually very lucky that he spent so little time with his father when he was a small boy.
It's not something I feel terribly comfortable saying about anybody else. I mean, that's for him to say. But from an outsider's perspective, doing all the research, I just think that the father was a brilliant man, very frustrated man who was also an alcoholic, and beyond that was physically abusive.
To his wives.
I don't know for certain that he was abusive to Stanley Ann Dunham, Barack Obama's mother, because they were only together for a very brief amount of time and she's no longer living. But his next wife, his third wife, who was also an American, Ruth Baker Indesanjo, I spent a long afternoon with her as she told me one horrific story after another about the physical abuse that she endured at his hands several times when she was afraid for her life. And so that certainly would have been a difficult situation for a young boy to have to deal with. And in that sense, even though his book is called Dreams from My Father and he puts so much emphasis on his father in the book, even though he was never around, I think that in truth, he's better off not knowing his dad.
I want to play a clip from the very end of that book, Obama reading the audiobook, and this is after he's gone to Africa to meet his extended family, and he's reflecting on his father.
With the degree, the ascot, the American wife, the car, the words, the figures, the wallet, the proper proportion of tonic to gin, the polish, the panache, the entire thing seamless and natural, without the cobbled-together, haphazard quality of an earlier time, what could stand in his way? He had almost succeeded, in a way his own father could never have hoped for. And then, after seeming to travel so far, to discover that he had not escaped after all, to discover that he remained trapped on his father's island with its fissures of anger and doubt and defeat, the emotions still visible beneath the surface, hot and molten and alive like a wicked yawning mouth, and his mother gone away. I dropped to the ground and swept my hand across the smooth yellow tile. "Oh, father," I cried, "there was no shame in your confusion, just as there had been no shame in your father's before you, no shame in the fear or in the fear of his father before him. There was only shame in the silence fear had produced. It was the silence that betrayed us."
That silence being all that was unsaid between various members of the Obama family?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very evocative and beautifully written and expresses an emotion that I think is powerful and real, and yet it's not the story as I know it. I don't think that there was much silence about Barack Obama Sr. And I don't know that it was, I mean, I think that it is true that he was caught in a way between centuries almost, that he'd grown up in Western Kenya in, you know, in relative, you know, primitive situation, and was the first part of the first wave of Kenyans to go overseas to the United States to be educated. And that juxtaposition certainly was jarring. And he was a nationalist, a follower of Tom Mboya, a great Luo leader who was trying to bring together the divisive tribalism of Kenya and was unable to do it. And Mboya himself was eventually assassinated. So there certainly were a lot of frustrations that Barack Obama Sr., the father, had to deal with. And those are completely understandable and powerful. Yet there were some other failings that are universal. You know, they can't be just attributed to conditions. And some of those got him into a lot of trouble, you know, in his life. And you know, you have to take some personal responsibility for that. But as a son, in writing a memoir where the search for the father is the essence of the book, I'm not trying to denigrate in any way what Barack Obama wrote, and he certainly read it very powerfully there.
But it's interesting how you describe that book, Dreams from My Father, and of course that's how many of us first really learned about the story of Barack Obama. You say this properly falls in the category of literature and memoir, not history and autobiography. We should not read that as factually accurate. For one thing, as has been widely reported, he creates composite characters instead of actual people, which he himself has acknowledged.
Yes, he does that in his introduction.
Yeah. What do you see as some of the most important ways that Obama strayed from the real story in that book?
Well, you know, I let him read the introduction to my book before I interviewed him. And you know, in the Oval Office, after a little talk about the Packers and Bears to start with.
You being a Packer fan, and
he being a Bears fan, yes. He said, "David, you know, I read your introduction. It's very interesting, but you call my book fiction." And I looked over at Jay Carney, the press secretary, who had a copy of it and was madly scrambling to find that section. I hadn't. I called it literature. I was complimenting him in a way. But there is a vast difference between memoir and rigorous factual biography. So he does acknowledge that there are composites in the book and that there are certain compressions. What I found was, you know, some of the stories in his book were family mythologies passed along and somewhat innocently passed along by him as well. You know, his parents or grandparents had told him stories and they were the family story. When you think about it, any of us have certain things that we've been told by our parents and grandparents that if a biographer were to go back and check, might not be quite the story as it really was. So that's one genre of it. And in that sense, you know, he said that his Kenyan grandfather was imprisoned and tortured by the British. I have to say there's a shred of possibility that happened. I could find, there are no documents saying it. And I interviewed six people who knew the grandfather fairly well who said it didn't happen. The only one who ever said it did was his step-grandmother, Mama Sarah, who I found to be a somewhat unreliable witness. So that was one of the stories he passed along. Similarly, he said that his step-grandfather in Indonesia was killed as a martyr fighting the Dutch for independence. And in fact, he died falling off a stool in his living room, changing the drapes. A slightly different story. And then there are composites in the book. One woman named Regina, who he meets at Occidental College as a young man, is supposed to represent sort of a vibrant African-American family life. There is no Regina. Part of that character is drawn from one of his white friends at Occidental, Carolyn Boss. Many of the characteristics, including the name Regina, which was Carolyn's grandmother's name. And part of it is drawn from Michelle Obama, who he hadn't met and wouldn't for many years. Then in his book, he writes about a white girlfriend in New York whom he loved. Sort of a major point in the book that every reporter who's ever the book wanted to know who that was. And I found her. And it turns out that that New York girlfriend, Genevieve Cook, was an Australian, and that parts of her character as Obama portrayed it in the book are not her. She is a composite, he claimed. When I interviewed him in the Oval Office, he said, well, that's not all Genevieve. It's also some other girlfriends. So, you know, things like that. It's a really interesting dilemma for me because I don't want to defend President Obama. That's not my job. And in fact, I would never write a book, even a memoir, with composites or compressed chronology in it, although I think some of that inevitably comes from your own memory, which is faulty. So I accept that part of it, and I accept the passing along of the mythology of the family.
I guess the question is whether anything very important
was altered. I don't think so. I don't really think so. I mean, I think that his book was an attempt to convey his internal struggle as he was searching for his identity. And the original title of the book and the first proposal which I got was Journeys in Black and White. And he's looking at his life through the lens of race. So what's happened essentially to some degree is that his detractors, the doubters, the birthers, that whole group has dismissed my book as hagiography on one hand, and then on the other hand tried to latch on to these discrepancies that I found in his book to claim that his book is fraudulent. You know, if I were to put on a scale the balance between many of their mythologies that they've passed along about Obama versus his memoir, theirs is far more fraudulent than anything he did. And without trying to defend him, I understand what he did and why he did it, and I don't think it's a huge deal.
You mentioned that a huge subject of that book was Obama coming to terms with race, I mean,
yes,
with his peculiar upbringing, and particularly, as he puts it, his father was black as pitch and his mother as white as milk. And I want to play another excerpt from his audiobook where he's reflecting back at the time when he's in college and what it meant to be black.
Since my first frightening discovery of Bleaching Creams in Life magazine, I'd become familiar with the lexicon of color consciousness within the black community. Good hair, bad hair, thick lips or thin, if you're light, you're all right, if you're black, get back. In college, the politics of black fashion and the questions of self-esteem that fashion signified had been a frequent, if delicate, topic of conversation for black students, especially among the women, who would smile bitterly at the sight of the militant brother who always seemed to be dating light-skinned girls, and tongue-lash any black man who was foolish enough to make a remark about a black woman's hairstyle. Mostly, I had kept quiet when these subjects were broached, privately measuring my own degree of infection. But I noticed that such conversations rarely took place in large groups, and never in front of whites. Later, I would realize that the position of most black students in predominantly white colleges was already too tenuous, our identities too scrambled, to admit to ourselves that our black pride remained incomplete. And to admit our doubt and confusion to whites, to open up our psyches to general examination by those who had caused so much of the damage in the first place, seemed ludicrous, itself an expression of self-hatred. For there seemed no reason to expect that whites would look at our private struggles as a mirror into their own souls, rather than yet more evidence of black pathology. It was in observing that division, I think, between what we talked about privately and what we addressed publicly, that I'd learned not to put too much stock in those who trumpeted black self-esteem as a cure for all our ills, whether substance abuse or teen pregnancy or black-on-black crime.
So the question of black identity was obviously hugely important to Obama's coming of age. I mean, sort of figuring out what his own identity was. Do you think he resolved those questions?
Well, we think about even from his birth, he, on the one hand, was born with black skin, so he had to deal with race in America from the very beginning. On the other hand, he grew up with a white mother and white grandparents and not knowing his father, and so he had to learn African-American culture. And so what I consider to be the arc of his life is a search for home and for racial identity, which runs from his high school years, but predominantly once he got off the island, getting off the rock of Oahu, as they call it, and into the mainland, starting with the period that he's in that audio is when he's at Occidental College in Los Angeles. I think that from there through the next 9 years, from Los Angeles to New York to Chicago, really, really intense personal introspection into who he is and what he could be. I think that while again that part that we had him read is very evocative and in general insightful about the black dilemma, it doesn't quite fit his own story as cleanly as one might think. He during that whole period, most of his girlfriends were white, and he was fairly open to them about his own racial struggle. You know, it wasn't something that he was holding back.
So at one point, he kind of identified himself as black and white rather than black, which is...
I don't think he ever identified himself as black and white. I think he was struggling to figure out what he was. You know, when he was after those 2 years at Occidental, where at Occidental for the first time, even though there wasn't a large African-American cohort there, he was with classmates and peers who were black, really for the first time. There were very few at Punahou School in Honolulu. But he was not particularly comfortable with many of those black students who came from Compton or inner cities or Philadelphia and so on. And he was more of an internationalist. His real friends, his closest friends at Occidental were neither black nor white. They were Pakistanis. He was more comfortable in that realm in many respects. But he was trying to learn how to be an African-American. And so that process was more internalized than it was outward in that period. When he got to New York, none of the leaders of the Black Student Organization of Columbia remembered him, really, except for this lanky guy walking across the campus. He told me when he was in the Oval Office, and I interviewed him, that he made no permanent lasting black friends during that whole 4 years in New York. It was a little more complex than he portrayed it in that story, but it was just as intense. It was just a little different. He was trying to learn. He was trying to figure himself out. And, you know, while he was in New York for many months, he carried a frayed copy of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man around with him. And in some sense, he was Invisible Man. He was black skinned, but neither culturally black nor white yet, and he was trying to find his home.
Why do you think it was so important for him eventually to identify as black?
Well, I think it had to do with feeling at home. And, you know, perhaps he's of the last, I mean, we're always thinking about, you know, the march of time and the progress that mankind has made in terms of race. And it comes slowly, but I think that even between Barack Obama's generation and the generation of kids in their teens and early 20s now, there is a difference, and that more of them are less defining themselves by race particularly, and more multiracial kids are comfortable just being that in and of itself. In Barack Obama's generation, there was more of pressure to define yourself as black or white.
Probably the feeling that you had to choose sides.
You had to choose sides. And I think here's what he figured out, which is a sort of a delicate thing to figure out. He figured out that personally, to be comfortable, to find his home personally, he had to become an African-American. And that's sort of the arc that leads toward Michelle Robinson Obama in Chicago.
And even before that is when he stopped calling himself Barry and started referring to himself as Barack.
Yeah, there's some element of going back to his roots in Kenya with that. But, You know, his father wasn't Barack. His father was Barrack. You know, it was a British pronunciation. But even during that period when he started becoming Barack, you know, his friends were white girlfriends and Pakistani among the others, and very few African Americans. But what he had to figure out was, personally, he had to find his home in the African American community. For his larger existence, he had to figure out how to get it more than that. And there's a letter that he wrote that when he was 22, that sort of struck me, where he just describes his Punahou friends and Occidental friends and New York friends all finding comfortable niches in life and choices they would make professionally and personally. And he wrote that he couldn't quite feel himself whole unless he tried to embrace it all. Any one of those would disappoint him individually. And I think that's the political expression of Barack Obama, that personally he had to find himself in the African-American community, but in his presentation to the world, he had to embrace it, try to embrace it all.
And that certainly has been the story since he's been president.
Oh, well, even before, you know, I mean, I think that is, that letter that he wrote in 1982 is sort of an early evocation of his convention speech in 2004, by which we all know him, where he was trying to present the universality of his existence and hoping that there could be a commonality in America that transcended red and white, red and blue states and all of that, which at once offered the promise of Obama and also perhaps some of his political naivete or hopes beyond reality.
How far back can you trace Obama's presidential ambitions? When did he start talking to friends about this crazy idea that maybe someday he could become president?
Well, it's certainly not like Bill Clinton, the other president whose biography I've written. You know, with Clinton, he ran for every office as in high school until his principal came to him and said, "Billy, you can't run anymore. We're sick of you. You dominate everything." So he ran for class secretary instead of president and got defeated by a woman. Or a girlfriend who would, you know, he wouldn't talk to after that. You don't see that with Obama. At Occidental, you see the first stirrings of some sense that he had a larger purpose in the world. In New York, one of his friends, Binu Mahmood, one of the Pakistanis who was going to New York University Law School and was a friend of his friends from Occidental, and quite an intellectual, vivid personality. Binu recalled to me that one day Barack said, "Do you think that I could ever be president of the United States?" And what he was really asking is, do you think a black person could be president?
How old was he then?
He was 22. And when I asked President Obama about that incident, when I interviewed him, he said he didn't quite remember it, but if Binu remembers it, maybe it happened. So he wasn't denying it. That's the first instance, but it wasn't something that one would see so clearly with someone like Clinton constantly yearning for that. With Barack Obama, it was a slow evolution.
But it does suggest real ambition going way back.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, his mother, even though she wasn't always there with him during his adolescence, teenage years, and so on, was kind of the conscience pounding away at him, you know. In high school, he'd played basketball and smoked dope, basically, and that was pretty much his life. And his mother kept saying, you know, "You can't just be a good time Charlie Bear. You got more to you than that. You're special." And he started to think about that more as he matured, and that translated into a larger ambition.
Of course, the question always with the people who become presidents is, what drives them?
Right.
And I mean, there's the sense that they're not like the rest of us. They are, you don't want to say freaks, but they're somehow different.
Yeah,
and
well,
so is it ego? I mean, for Obama, ego, is it wanting to change the world, to be a transformative figure in political history? What's your sense?
I think, well, you can never dismiss ego. I mean, that has to be there for any politician successfully. You know, he has this cool exterior. In Hawaii, it's the saying is cool head main thing, you know, just be cool, man. But And Clinton, so I would say Obama's cool, Clinton's hot, you know, really polar opposites in their presentation. And yet inside, the fire burns at the same temperature. You know, he has a huge competitive will. Ask anybody who's played basketball or poker or with him. And it's evident in his politics as too. Sometimes he appears to be a little bit too non-confrontational. And that also is another aspect of his personality. But it's not because he doesn't want to prevail. It's because he's looking for another way to succeed and to avoid the traps that life has presented him all along the way. So I would say that his mother's conscience, the desire to change the world, is probably number one. Competitive will is number two, which ego goes along with that. Yeah. And it is as deeply burning as any politician's.
Your biography ends when Obama's 27. He's heading off to Harvard Law School, so well before he became a public figure. Is the Obama of today pretty much the same person as that 27-year-old?
Well, he always had self-confidence, but I would say that my second volume will begin with Harvard Law School, where he, for the first time, he was competing against the cream of his generation intellectually or in terms of ambition, and he figured out that he knew how to do that, you know, that he could succeed there. He was elected president of the Harvard Law Review, the first African American, and it was because of his competence and his ability to negotiate a lot of different personalities and ideologies. So, and he's someone who, you know, some people never change. They just become more so, repeat the same mistakes over and over again. I see a pattern in Barack Obama's life of learning and growing. So I wouldn't say that in every respect he's the same person, but a lot of his characteristics are there and have not changed. And that includes that sort of notion of trying to figure out where the traps are and get around them, which can sometimes in his presidency make him appear to be a little behind the curve, and his supporters in particular wondering why isn't he being more confrontational and clarifying the issues. Usually, you know, for better or worse, he's trying to figure out where the trap is and get around it, whether it's don't ask, don't tell, which for 2 years the human rights, the gay community was upset at him, really pounding at him. You know, you promised this, why didn't you do it? He was figuring out how to get the military to come along, and once he changed it, their frustrations are forgotten. But he was looking beyond where they were in the immediacy of the moment, trying to figure out how to get somewhere else.
So he almost never just jumps into the fray.
No, he's very deliberate.
He examines things first.
Yes, and, you know, sometimes that can be frustrating. When he was a community organizer, the whole notion is to confront and demand and push, and it's the only way you get even an ounce of, you know, you're confronting power. You have no power, so you have to be that way. He wasn't. His mentors would sometimes go mad trying to get him to take action, you know, to stage a sit-in in a government office or something, which was not his style. And you see that in his presidency as well, that reluctance to confront, to be very deliberative. And yet, as Jerry Kelman, who was the person who hired him to be a community organizer in Chicago, told me, Barack would deliberate and drive me crazy. And then every once in a while, he'd take a very bold action. And I think you see that in his presidency as well, whether it's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or going after bin Laden, or healthcare. He is someone who doesn't want to just survive. He wants to do something big and bold, and he's just trying to figure out how he can do it.
You've now spent a lot of time looking into this man's life, and you're now writing Volume 2. Is there anything you're still struggling to figure out about his personality, about what makes him tick?
Well, there are always, I mean, I never feel satisfied that I've, I mean, 95% of any human being is interior, and it's hard to get there. I mean, I think we had the advantage with Barack Obama of him being a writer himself, and so laying out a little more interior than we usually see with most politicians. But still, there are aspects of him that I hope to find, but I might never, you know. And so I can only, you know, I think through letters and journals and so on, I was able to get close. He kept a journal for, he probably maybe still is, although in this subpoena-hungry era, I doubt it. But, you know, he considered himself a writer.
But however, that journal, I assume, has not come to light publicly.
Well, you know, of course I ask for it. Many, many journals. But, you know, he used his journals in his book. And I'm sure he'll write books after he's elected. And, you know, I'm not going to get them after he's gone, but I'll be gone too. You know, someday some biographer will come along with all of that material. And that's the way it should be. You know, there's never a permanent, I'm hoping to lay the groundwork, but I think there'll be hundreds of books written about the first African-American president over the next century, if books still exist.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you, Steve.